This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, August 27, 2002. I'm Deepa Fernandez. As Dick Cheney steps up the drumbeat for war on Iraq, the Saudis meet with the president in Texas. Texas is set to execute another juvenile tomorrow night. And UC Berkeley unions strike for fair pay negotiations. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The United Nations World Summit on Sustainable Development is underway in South Africa. Patrick Bond reports from Johannesburg.
Police repression here is fierce in the run-up to Saturday's protest marches by the landless, by NGOs and trade unions, and by radical social movements. The plush suburb of Sandton is already a fortress, and further attacks on protesters and mass arrests are expected in coming days. The proceedings inside the Sandton Convention Center have raised expectations today of a deal involving lower subsidies for northern farmers and industries, but the low-level U.S. delegation is resisting virtually all appeals for meaningful targets and timeframes. From Johannesburg, this is Patrick Bond for Free Speech Radio News.
We'll have more on the Earth Summit coming up. The United Nations top official in Afghanistan is rejecting calls for an investigation into an alleged massacre of Taliban prisoners. Susan Wood reports from the UN.
The UN Special Envoy for Afghanistan, Lakhdar Brahimi, today said no probe should be conducted into a suspected mass gravesite in the north allegedly containing Taliban prisoners' remains unless witnesses are guaranteed protection against reprisals.
But I'm sure you will agree that our responsibility to the living has to have precedence as far as we, the United Nations, are concerned. And we cannot take a risk of putting anyone's life in danger.
Following a report in Newsweek magazine that more than 1,000 prisoners allegedly suffocated while being transported in shipping containers after they surrendered to the U.S.-backed Northern Alliance, the Afghan government last week promised to investigate, but Brahimi said President Hamid Karzai's government doesn't have the capacity to investigate and would need help from outside. The gravesite is in territory controlled by Afghan warlord Abdul Rashid Dostum, with whom U.S. forces were working closely at the time the alleged massacre occurred. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
A court in Bhopal, India, began hearing a landmark case today in which the Indian government is accused of attempting to reduce the charges in one of the world's worst industrial disasters. Vinod K. Jose has more from New Delhi.
On December 3, 1984, a holding tank at the Union Carbide Pesticide Factory in Bhopal overheated and burst. Methyl isocyanate and at least 65 other toxic gases spread across the city in a cloud, killing over 5,000 people within 3 days. According to the victims group called Bhopal Group for Information and Action, at least 20,000 people have died as a result of exposure to the gases in the last 17 years. Warren Anderson, then CEO of Union Carbide, has been charged in India with culpable homicide, which is punishable by imprisonment for life. The victims now say the Indian government has been pressurized by Washington to reduce the charges in order to prevent the extradition of Warren Anderson. To date, victims have received little or no assistance. From New Delhi, in India, this is Vinod Jose for Free Speech Radio News.
4 Michigan newspapers and a Democratic congressman won the right to attend the immigration hearing of a Detroit resident. The first appeals court-level decision against the Bush administration's so-called war on terrorism. Gareth Schweitzer reports from D.C.
The court ruled that the immigration hearing of Lebanese-born Rabi Haddad, whose Muslim charity had its assets frozen by the Justice Department, must be open to the public. The decision stated that the blanket closure of deportation hearings on national security grounds was an attempt by the Bush administration to, quote, place its actions behind closed doors. Carrie Moss, executive director of the Michigan American Civil Liberties Union, praised the decision.
What we objected to here was the government's decision that they could just on their own arbitrarily close an entire proceeding to the press and the public.
A Newark judge has ruled that all deportations nationwide must be open to public scrutiny unless the Department of Justice can offer case-by-case proof of why such levels of secrecy are necessary. A Philadelphia appeals court will hear the Newark case next month. That case could decide whether the Justice Department chooses to appeal yesterday's decision in Cincinnati. In Washington, D.C., for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gareth Schweitzer.
And finally, a report just released by two human rights groups say ethnic and religious clashes in Nigeria have left 10,000 people dead over the past 3 years. Sam Olukoya has the details in Lagos.
The 200-page report titled Hope Betrayed was released by the Geneva-based World Organization Against Torture and the Lagos Center for Law Enforcement Education. It covered the last 3 years since Nigeria returned to civil rule. The report said 10,000 people have died within the period, while hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced as a result of ethnic and religious clashes in the country. The human rights group said the violence were either orchestrated by government officials for political reasons or as a result of the government's failure to react to warnings. The human rights groups have called on the United Nations to send investigators to probe their allegations against the Nigerian government. The government is yet to comment on the report. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos, Nigeria.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Saudi Arabia's ambassador to the U.S. visited President Bush's ranch in Crawford, Texas today. The Saudis are simultaneously trying to satisfy a U.S. government bent on attacking Iraq and their Arab neighbors who oppose the idea. The Saudis say they won't let the U.S. use Saudi bases to fight a new war. But students of U.S.-Saudi relations say the White House can convince the Saudis to change their mind. Joshua Chaffin has this report.
Just hours before the meeting this morning, the Saudis said the Americans haven't made a strong enough case for attacking Iraq. In recent days, U.S. officials have called Saddam Hussein a serious threat to the U.S., but they continually refuse to offer new information to prove it. Vice President Cheney spoke to World War II veterans on Monday.
Many of us are convinced that Saddam Hussein will acquire nuclear weapons fairly soon. Just how soon, we cannot really gauge. Intelligence is an uncertain business, even in the best of circumstances.
No Arab country publicly supports an attack against Baghdad. Saudi Arabia says it won't let the U.S. use its air bases the way it did in the 1991 Gulf War. But Michael Clare with the Peace and World Security Studies Department at Hampshire College in Massachusetts says the Saudi royal family is in no position to defy the U.S. right now.
They're facing a very serious situation in their region because the U.S. is about to go to war with Iraq. The Saudi government is very fearful of the consequences of that, and there's growing anti-Saudi sentiment among the U.S. leadership. And I can imagine they're very desperate to talk with George Bush and get some assurances about the future of U.S.-Saudi ties.
De facto Saudi ruler and friend of the Bush family, Prince Abdullah, suppresses the press coverage, but anti-American feelings run deep in his country. Violent pro-Palestinian demonstrations have rocked Saudi Arabia in recent months. 15 of the 19th September 11th hijackers were Saudis, as are more than a quarter of the so-called detainees at the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And with his father, King Fahd, in declining health, Abdullah reportedly faces the possibility of a coup from members of his own family who are sympathetic to al-Qaeda. Jonathan Wells co-authored a series on the Bush family ties to the Saudi royal family for the Boston Herald last year. He says the Saudis more than ever need the U.S. protection they've always counted on in exchange for oil.
It's really a business elite to business elite kind of relationship, the business elite in Saudi Arabia being the royal family, and our business elite, which many of whom, as we know, shuffle in and out of federal government at very high levels. Cheney is an example. He was CEO of Halliburton, a huge oil services company with contracts in Saudi Arabia. Now he's vice president. There are dozens of others, and that cannot be minimized, I think, that there are these relationships that involve enormous amounts of money. And frankly, you have to wonder to what extent there's some conflict of interest there.
Reporter Wells says a U.S. attack on Iraq would leave Saudi Arabia open to attacks from its neighbors, who resent Abdullah's close ties to Washington. What would happen then to the value of U.S. investment in Saudi Arabia? Professor Clare says that question has caused the biggest foreign policy divide in U.S. government since the Vietnam era.
Those people like James Baker, who are cautioning against a precipitous move in the Persian Gulf, I think are very closely allied with the oil companies that are allied with the Saudi royal family, and they want to preserve the status quo. I think there are other Republican interests who look at Iraq as a vast oil prize just waiting to be plucked. Dick Cheney talked about Iraq in his speech possessing 10% of the world's oil reserves. Here's a chance to turn it over to American companies and therefore weaken the hold that Saudi Arabia has on global oil prices.
The Bush administration is arguing with Congress over whether it needs congressional approval for an attack on Iraq. The Asia Times estimates at least 105,000 U.S. and allied troops are already assembled around and inside Iraq. And for the first time since Vietnam, the Defense Department has told 14,000 military reservists they may have to extend their duty for another year. Josh Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
In what may be the biggest strike at UC Berkeley in decades, workers represented by several unions walked off their jobs yesterday, the first day of fall classes. The campus's clerical workers' union originally called the three-day strike, but three other unions representing lecturers, graduate student instructors, and nurses are honoring the picket lines. The last time UC Berkeley saw a strike involving multiple unions was 3 decades ago in 1972. From Berkeley, Vanessa Tate has more.
Picketers circled the campus early Monday morning, disrupting operations as the university's 30,000 students showed up for fall classes. Delivery drivers refused to cross picket lines, while unionized construction workers walked off major job sites. UC's clerical workers have been in bargaining for 15 months and are upset at what they say is the university's bad faith bargaining. Nancy Manel is a library worker and a member of the Coalition of University Employees, the Clerical Workers Union.
UC has been bargaining illegally by dragging its feet, not bringing information to the bargaining table, giving unilateral proposals, walking out on bargaining. We're really sick of it. It's 15 months. We're living hand to mouth, and they can't settle the contracts. So we're on strike because of their bad faith bargaining at the table.
The unions have filed several unfair labor practice charges against UC, but the university claims the strike is illegal. UC spokesperson Paul Schwartz.
Where we're going to resolve our differences is at the bargaining table, not on the street corner. Not at the campus plaza.
Supporters came to a noontime rally to vent their anger at what they say is UC's arrogance toward its workers. Margie Wilkinson, chief negotiator for the clerical union.
When your employer doesn't treat you fairly, when it disrespects you and disrespects the process that you have both committed to, it is not responsible to just sit there and take it. The only responsible thing to do is to say, no more. For those of us who work for UC, those of us who order the books, open the classrooms, do the work for the professors, register the students, take care of the students' children. I'm losing track of all the things we do. Pay the bills, everything that keeps this place running. For those of us, it means on strike, shut it down.
Lecturers who have been working without a contract for over 2 years are striking over their own lengthy and, they say, frustrating bargaining process. Jim Stockinger teaches sociology and is a member of the American Federation of Teachers.
This university is increasingly being managed by a bunch of corporate-minded executives who have no connection and no respect for the higher purposes to which this great public institution has been dedicated. When you work for UC, you get used to being pushed around. You get used to being told that the worker you just worked with is not going to be replaced, and you have to do their job. You get used to having your representatives sneered at in unconscionably long bargaining procedures. The administration of this university thinks that it can get away with pushing all of us around. Today, tomorrow, Wednesday, we push back.
While the clerical strike is officially about bad faith bargaining, the two sides are far apart on wages. UC is offering a 2% wage increase. The clerical union wants 15% over 2 years to bring their pay up to prevailing market rates. UC spokesperson Paul Schwartz says the university has made its final offer.
Contract settlement is going to require the union to compromise as well, not just the university. It takes two to reach an agreement, and we are doing everything that we can. We have been bargaining with Q for 15 months now. We have put proposal after proposal on the table, including our last final offer, which was on August 7th. We've yet to receive the union's response to that offer.
Bargaining is scheduled to resume early next month. Meanwhile, union activists on several of UC's other 8 campuses are planning strikes or protests in the near future.
No contract!
No peace!
No contract!
No peace!
In Berkeley, I'm Vanessa Tate for Free Speech Radio News.
No contract!
No peace!
No contract!
No peace!
The UN World Summit for Sustainable Development, which began yesterday in Johannesburg, is being attended by around 60,000 delegates, including 100 heads of state. President Bush is the notable absentee. Yesterday, activists charged that the summit would be a sham if businesses walked away with better deals than those there to protect it. There is a big business lobby present in Johannesburg, possibly why the summit is being held in Sandton City, touted as being the richest square mile in Africa, catering exclusively to white, wealthy South Africans. A score of Greenpeace activists demonstrating in front of a nuclear plant have already been arrested, and various reports say combat helicopters are on alert, with security and armed forces trained for any emergency, including air attacks. And while the Earth Summit continues, Free Speech Radio News correspondent Rupert Cook takes a look at some of the environmental problems plaguing the Sudan.
Being treated for Kalazar is a particularly painful experience. The disease is sometimes compared to HIV/AIDS, in that it suppresses the body's immune system so that opportunistic infections flourish. The patient takes on an emaciated, wasted appearance, and if untreated, usually dies. There is a cure, but the daily injections over a 30-day treatment program are exceptionally uncomfortable. The drug is highly toxic and the doses large. But, despite all the pain, the patients in this southern Sudanese Kalazar clinic, run by international NGO Dutch Doctors Without Borders, are relatively fortunate. Until November last year, in this part of the eastern Upper Nile region, like virtually everywhere else in southern Sudan, there were no facilities for the treatment of Kalazar. Most patients died. Kalazar is spread by the bite of the sandfly, a tiny insect which tends to bite at dusk. The sandfly breeds under the acacia tree, and acacia trees are everywhere in southern Sudan. Dennis Kerr is the Doctors Without Borders project coordinator in the eastern Upper Nile region.
So the acacia tree, the red acacia tree, the sandflies live and breed around the red acacia tree. And up until 1950s in this part of Sudan, there was very few red acacia trees, but there was a big flood in that time, and then the vegetation changed and red acacia trees came back. And with that, the sandflies have come. And so they mainly stay within up to 200 metres of the red acacia trees and only bite at night. So they're a big problem with Kalazar.
It's around 10 o'clock in the morning in the health clinic in Magang, and as one can hear, there are quite a few people here, mainly young mothers with their babies. This is the time when the patients get given their injections for Kalazar, which is the major scourge affecting the population here. So Dennis, what's happening right now?
Since we've started, we're now seeing a decrease in the number of patients, which to us is very good because they have been suffering a lot. And with the cold conditions and the lack of water and the lack of food, things are looking very, very dire for the future.
There are a lot of children crying around us. Is that just because the injection is so painful?
Yeah, the injections is very painful, and they receive one injection for 30 days. So, and as you see, some of them are quite malnourished and they don't have much muscle to absorb the medicine. And one thing about Kalazar, it's a very insidious onset. Some of these patients have been unwell for 5 or 6 months, and now we're seeing them at the end of the disease. So they came to us very sick. They have a large number of intercurrent illnesses. The main one that we're seeing now is pneumonia and diarrhea diseases. And we do suspect some cases of TB, tuberculosis.
If you weren't treating these patients with Kalazar, they'd die, wouldn't they?
Up to 90% of patients with Kalazar die if they're not treated correctly. Yes, a lot of these would have died.
The effect of the disease upon the communities of southern Sudan has been devastating. Mayak Ding is the elected SPLA executive officer for Sobat County in the eastern Upper Nile region.
Yes, he said about Kalazar, it is a main disease in the area. We suffer a lot, or our community have suffered a lot. It started in 1955. So up to now, it is still existing in the area, and it lost many lives of our community. Even children and elders and everybody have died in case of Kalazar.
It's thought that the Kalazar epidemic in the south of Sudan was precipitated by the war and the subsequent population displacements which spread the disease from the north of the country. Perversely, though, the war has also seen a marked increase in the ubiquity of the acacia tree. The population displacements and destruction of the rural economy have, in part, allowed the tree to run rampant. However, the tree is also of benefit to the local population. It secretes a gum which, for the often famine-affected southern Sudanese, is a means of fending off hunger. Also, the great acacia forests provide cover against the government bombers, which are constantly looking for targets. Austin Davis is director of Dutch Doctors Without Borders.
It's one of the food sources for their cattle, and they live off their cattle. And it's not just cutting them down near your house, because people aren't that sedentary. People go from the village to the cattle camps, they go from the cattle camps to the fishing camps, and these things are 10, 15, 20 kilometres apart, and there's no way you can cut down the acacia trees in all the areas you move through. The really devastating impact of the war in the areas that you're talking about with large acacia tree is ground attack against civilian populations. Sudden movement, coming in, taking over villages, taking all the cattle, burning all the food, burning all the huts down, maybe kidnapping children, raping some women, and holding it for a couple of days and then moving out. So the forests, of course, provide cover for that. It's what the cattle will often eat in dry season, particularly the goats eat a lot of the acacia.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rupert Cook in Sobat County, southern Sudan.
Tomorrow night, Texas is set to execute its third juvenile this summer. Toronto Patterson, a young African-American, was 17 at the time he was arrested and convicted of killing his cousin and her two small children. Of the 22 states that allow execution of offenders who are under the age of 18 at the time of their crime, only 7 have actually executed a juvenile since the death penalty was reinstated in 1976. Of the 20 juveniles sent to their state-sanctioned deaths, Texas has executed over half. From Houston, Renee Feltz brings us reaction to the pending death by legal injection of Toronto Patterson.
The death penalty is so routine in Texas that when Toronto Patterson was condemned to die in a hotly contested trial in 1995, it made page 23 of the Dallas Morning News. State prosecutors argued that Patterson broke into his cousin's Dallas County home to steal the gold and chrome rims off of a car in her garage and then shot his cousin and her two daughters in the head. Patterson has always maintained his innocence. One of the most damaging pieces of evidence in the case is a confession Patterson made to a Dallas County police detective. His current attorney, J. Gary Hart, argues that there is strong evidence this confession was coerced by a corrupt police detective who has an established reputation for coerced confessions in other cases.
A month later, this same police detective
with another capital murder suspect who was actually in his early 20s using very similar kinds of tactics. Same police officer extracted a confession from another capital murder suspect, which was later shown to be utterly false.
Hart says Patterson's original attorney tried to use this information to demonstrate to the jury that young people who are intimidated and scared by such tactics sometimes confess to crimes they did not commit. The state trial judge refused to admit this evidence. Attorney Gary Hart.
The court was more solicitous of the reputation of the police officer than the life of a young capital murder suspect who was on trial for his life.
But Hart is most disturbed by the failure of Patterson's trial lawyers to raise the issue of his juvenile status.
The biggest breakdown, I think, in Toronto's case was the fact that although he was only 17 at the time of the offense, that was a fact that was not utilized at the punishment phase of his trial in an effort to try to convince the jury that he should receive a life sentence as opposed to the death penalty.
Texas is backed by the United States Supreme Court in its approval of juvenile executions, but Hart suggests that this approval is conditional.
The main thing that the Supreme Court really regarded as making it constitutional in the first place to execute a juvenile was that juries could be educated about these things. It didn't happen in Toronto's case.
Hart points to research which the jury did not hear.
Juveniles are more impulsive. They're less able to control their impulses. They're less able to foresee the consequences of their actions so that the death penalty does not really serve as a deterrent to them. And not only that, but they are more subject to rehabilitation than adult offenders because their personalities are not really fully formed yet.
Since this information was not raised in his original trial, it couldn't be used in Patterson's appeals, which are all now exhausted. This week, the case was considered by the Texas Board of Pardons and Parole, which is designed to act as a safeguard for death row prisoners because it can consider information not available to juries, such as the research on brain development cited by Patterson's current attorney. Yesterday, the board decided not to recommend a reprieve or commutation of Patterson's death sentence to life in prison. Only one board member voted in favor of such a commutation, basing his decision on the failure of Patterson's original attorneys to address Patterson's juvenile status. Patty Burwell.
If safeguards in place do not catch a problem, then we should do that.
While most board members were not moved by the juvenile status of Patterson, there is a growing awareness and discomfort in the state around this issue.
Even if people are not opponents of the death penalty generally, I think the mainstream of the religious communities particularly feel like the death penalty for juveniles is especially abhorrent.
B. Patterson is the director of Texas Impact, a statewide interfaith social justice advocacy group that believes most mainstream Judeo-Christian faiths oppose the death penalty. Impact works to develop awareness in congregations throughout the state on how the death penalty works. Ireland Beasley, whose son Napoleon was another juvenile executed in Texas this May, already knows how the death penalty works. He and his wife have been active in Patterson's case.
Disaster that was handed out to Napoleon is something that we're going to have to live with the rest of our lives. And we don't want to see no other family have to go through that part of it. If the governor or just somebody would just have a little compassion in their heart, it sure would be great, helpful in changing the situation. Not only Mr. Patterson, but the rest of the individuals that's on death row with these same issues.
Other than a 30-day stay of execution from Texas Governor Rick Perry, Patterson's last appeal for his life now rests in the hands of the U.S. Supreme Court. If the court agrees to consider his case, its decision may come as late as tomorrow evening, when Patterson is scheduled to die at 6 p.m. by lethal injection. I'm Renee Feltz in Houston, Texas, for Free Speech Radio News.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.